Today we will continue reading the Reverend Louis DeBoer's commentary on the Book of Esther, Chapter 15, Divine Deliverance, and Chapter 16, The Destruction of the Wicked. Chapter 15, Divine Deliverance, and reading Esther Chapter 8, Verses 1 and 2. On that day did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. And the king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it unto Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. The destruction of the wicked and the elevation of the righteous seem almost complete with these verses. In triplicate, God has in his ironic justice elevated his people at the expense of their enemies and his. Truly God has shown that he will have war with Amalek forever. First of all, Haman is slain, and his body is hung on the accursed tree that he had prepared for Mordecai. Second, Esther receives the entire estate of Haman, including his personal palace, slaves, and all his possessions, for house in the Bible generally means the entire household, not just the physical building. Thirdly, Mordecai, having been identified as Esther's stepfather, receives the king's signet ring and thereby enters into the office of the slain Haman. One is reminded of Psalm 113 and of the Magnificat. Psalm 113, verses 5 through 8. Who is like unto the Lord our God, who dwelleth on high, who humbleth himself to behold the things that are in heaven and in the earth? He raiseth up the poor out of the dust, and lifteth the needy out of the dunghill, that he may set him with princes, even with the princes of his people. And then reading Luke chapter 1, verses 47 through 52. And my spirit hath rejoiced in God my Savior, for he hath regarded the low estate of his handmaiden. For behold, from henceforth all generations shall call me blessed. For he that is mighty hath done to me great things, and holy is his name. And his mercy is on them that fear him from generation to generation. He hath showed strength with his arm. He hath scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He hath put down the mighty from their seats and exalted them of low degree. One wonders if Mary was thinking of Esther as she, under inspiration, uttered these lines. Esther was used of God to deliver his people from destruction. Mary was used of God to bring forth a Savior who would deliver God's people from sin and death and hell. The parallel is striking, and Mary is somewhat of a second Esther. Like the first Esther, succeeding generations will remember her and call her blessed. Reading Esther chapter 8, verses 3 through 6. And Esther spake yet again before the king, and fell down at his feet, and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite, and his device that he had devised against the Jews. Then the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king, and said, If it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews which are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that shall come unto my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? Esther again falls down before the king, this time not for her own life, as when she made her unauthorized entrance into the throne room, for she is in no danger now, but to plead for the lives of her people. Esther personally has been delivered and is in the highest favor of the king. Mordecai has been delivered from Haman's plot against him and has been elevated to the highest post of the royal court. Haman has been thoroughly discredited and destroyed, but God's people are still at risk of their lives. Haman may still appear to have the last laugh, although there is no laughter in the place of eternal torment to which God's justice has assigned him. His irrevocable decree still stands. The Jews of the empire are still slated for destruction on the 13th day of the 12th month. Therefore, Esther pleads with the king to put away, or cause to depart, or cause to pass over the plans of Haman for the destruction of her people. The phrasing here is important. Haman had signed and sealed his decree with the king's seal and in the king's name. The decrees of the kings of the Medes and the Persians were irrevocable. Esther can plead all she wants. The king can desire to grant her petitions. He has promised to grant her anything up to half of his kingdom, but he cannot revoke his own decrees. He cannot undo what Haman has done in his name. He is as trapped in his own folly as Darius was in the days of Daniel. Reading Daniel chapter 6, verses 12 through 16. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, The thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Then answered they and said before the king, That Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition 3 times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree or statute which the king establisheth may be changed. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. To put away the decree of Haman may pose a legal impossibility. However, Ahasuerus is favorably inclined toward Esther and her request. He extends the golden scepter to her that she may arise and proceed with her request. She repeats her request with even more precise language. She pleads for the king to reverse or put out of force or cause to return the decrees of Haman. Esther humbles herself once again before the king. She is pleading on her knees physically and emotionally. But it cannot avail. The king's decrees must stand. Esther adds another argument. She states that these are her people, these are her kindred, and she cannot bear to see their destruction. Her sentiments are a rebuke to the present-day internationalists who scorn ethnic ties and say that nation-states are obsolete. These Jews are Esther's people in 2 senses. First of all, ethnically. They are all the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Such racial kinship as Esther is expressing, is natural because it is a part of God's design. In Genesis chapter 10, we have a table of the nation states as they developed after the flood. The scripture makes plain that these nations were based on a common language and a common racial identity. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. Genesis 10:5. This is God's creation order, and Esther's sentiments reflect this. The second sense in which these are Esther's people is that they are the people of God. They are her people because they serve and worship her God. They are her people in the sense that Israel became Ruth's people when she said in Ruth chapter 1 verse 16, "Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God." Christians are commanded to love one another. Christians are commanded to care for each other. The texts are legion that require us to help our brothers and sisters in the faith when they are in need. Christ says that when we do so, it is as if we have done it unto him. And if we fail to do so, we will be held accountable by him on the last day. It is the people of God who are still under the threat of Haman's decree, and Esther cannot but do all that she can for their deliverance. And so should we when fellow Christians face peril and persecution in any part of the world. Reading Esther chapter 8. Verses 7 through 9. Then the king Ahasuerus said unto Esther the queen, and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and him they have hanged upon the gallows, because he laid his hand upon the Jews. Write ye also for the Jews, as it liketh you, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring, for the writing which is written in the king's name, and sealed with the king's ring, may no man reverse." Then were the king's scribes called at the time in the third month, that is, the month Sivan, on the 23rd day thereof. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded unto the Jews, and to the lieutenants, and to the deputies and rulers of the provinces, which are from India unto Ethiopia, 127 provinces, unto every province according to the writing thereof, and unto every people after their language, and to the Jews according to their writing, and according to their language. The king now gives his response to Esther's request. The response is given to both Esther and Mordecai, who is also present. Mordecai is prime minister, and the king also addresses him, perhaps because he will understand better than Esther the impossibility of reversing or revoking the decree of Haman with respect to the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai and Esther have probably conferred and decided that it is best that Esther, rather than Mordecai, make this request. Perhaps because an emotional appeal from the heart will be more effective rather than a lawyerly appeal from his new prime minister, but probably because Ahasuerus has already committed himself to granting any request of Esther up to one half of the kingdom. Esther had already made this request at the second banquet, but a proper response was never received because of the interruption caused by Haman's identification and subsequent execution. Now that the queen has renewed her request, the king needs to deal with the conundrum of his most generous promise versus the legal realities. The king is in a difficult situation. He has the combined difficulties of Darius, who wanted to save Daniel in the face of another unalterable decree, and of Herod, who wanted to save John the Baptist in the face of his foolish oath. He has before him an irrevocable decree to which he is now opposed, and he has a solemn promise whose fulfillment seems a legal impossibility. He starts off with recounting what he had already done for Esther, to show his good faith and put his limited response in as good a light as he can. He states that he has already partially fulfilled her request by the destruction of the man who had raised his hand against her people, and then he does the best that he can do to honor his word and her request. He gives Mordecai the same blank check with respect to the Jews that he gave to Haman. Mordecai can make any decree he desires with respect to the Jews, to seek their deliverance as Haman sought their destruction, and sign it with the king's ring and publish it in the king's name. This decree, as Haman's, will be unalterable. In essence, the king is granting Esther's request within the room that he has to maneuver, as he is somewhat on the horns of a dilemma, and is leaving the legal details to be worked out by Mordecai. If there is a way out, Mordecai has the unqualified authorization of the king to implement it. One may question the wisdom of Ahasuerus in doing this. He has gotten into this difficulty by issuing a blank check for an unalterable decree to Haman, and now he repeats that mistake. But he has little choice if he is to keep his word to Esther. And ultimately, he is fighting fire with fire, and maybe that is the best policy in this case. Mordecai does not hesitate to avail himself of this opportunity to deliver his people. The king's scribes are quickly called. The royal court of this vast empire is like the United Nations, with a veritable army of scribes and translators. They will issue the decree of Mordecai in every alphabet and every language of the kingdom. It will be sent to every community of Jews dispersed throughout the empire and to all the royal officials in charge of each province. Reading chapter 8, verses 10 through 13. And he wrote in the king Ahasuerus' name and sealed it with the king's ring, and sent letters by post on horseback, and riders on mules, camels, and young dromedaries, wherein the king granted the Jews which were in every city to gather themselves together, and to stand for their life, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all the power of the people and province that would assault them, both little ones and women, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. Upon one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, namely upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, the copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, and the Jews should be ready against that day to avenge themselves of their enemies. Although there is an abundance of time, Mordecai makes haste. It is only the third month, and the execution of Haman's decree is set for the 12th month. But Mordecai's decree is distributed throughout the empire expeditiously. But what are its contents? The writer has almost kept us in suspense while all these details are elaborated upon. Now we get to the issue of what Mordecai has written. He has all the knowledge of this situation. Knowledge, however, is not enough. He needs wisdom. The king and Mordecai have both had to wrestle with the same dilemma: how to undo Haman's decree without revoking it. The king has done his part. He has fought fire with fire and given Mordecai the same authority to save the Jews that he gave Haman to destroy them. Now Mordecai does his part, and he follows a similar strategy. He too will fight fire with fire. Haman's decree authorized all the enemies of the Jews to attack and exterminate them on a particular day. It authorized them to kill them all, men, women, and children, and to seize their property. Mordecai's decree does the same for the Jews. It authorizes them to gather on that same day and to kill and destroy their enemies, men, women, and children, and to seize their property as forfeit. At worst, he has even the odds. The Jews have the same authority as their enemies, and they now have 9 months to arm themselves and plan their defense. At worst, what was to be a massacre of a despised minority has become an equal battle in which the Jews are recognized as a specific subject people with definite rights. But in his wisdom, Mordecai has actually accomplished much more. The original decree not only consigned the Jews to slaughter and empowered their enemies, but it required the support and assistance of the provincial officials and their forces in the execution of this decree. For that reason, Mordecai's counter-decree authorized the Jews to defend themselves from all the power of the people and province that would assault them. And Mordecai's decree authorizing that defense is now sent to all the provincial governors and officials. By implication, they are to support and implement this decree also. That would be the logical requirement, as both decrees are in force and signed by the king. But that is a practical impossibility. They are going to have to choose, and the choice is simple. Haman, the Jew's enemy, is dead and disgraced. Mordecai, the Jew, is in favor and in power. Without legally revoking it, Mordecai has, for all practical purposes, made Haman's decree null and void as far as these officials are concerned. The Jews' enemies are still authorized to attack and destroy them, but they are now on their own. They will enjoy no official support from the empire and its forces. The Jews are now authorized to attack their enemies in self-defense, and they will probably enjoy imperial support throughout the provinces. God has answered the prayers of his people. God has honored his covenant promises. In God's providence, Esther and Mordecai have been his instruments to deliver his people. Reading Esther chapter 8, verses 14 through 17. So the posts that rode upon mules and camels went out, being hastened and pressed on by the king's commandment. And the decree was given at Shushan the palace. And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them all. Mordecai's decree is immediately posted to all the provinces and is published in Shushan, the city that was perplexed at the decree of Haman. Rejoices at the counter-decree of Mordecai. And not only are the Jews delivered, but Mordecai is given even more tokens of royal favor. The colors of his apparel are the colors that are prominent in the tabernacle. The tabernacle was typical of Christ. Does Mordecai's being arrayed in these colors set him up as a type of Christ? That is possible because Mordecai, like Christ, can be seen as a redeemer of God's people. But if the city of Shushan rejoiced at these developments, the Jews in the city were especially glad. Not only glad at their deliverance, but glad that their kinsman, according to the flesh, was now, like Daniel had been in Babylon, in charge of this vast empire, and willing to use his power for the good of his people. Not only were they filled with joy and gladness, but they were now held in honor. As the decree went out through the empire, the Jews of the various provinces shared in these feelings. One result of this was that many people converted to Judaism. When the Jews were a despised minority in captivity, there was little incentive to be a Ruth or a Rahab. But now that they are a favored minority, and now that Mordecai has come to power, many are willing to become proselytes to Judaism. This was not an unusual phenomenon. The scriptures record a similar event at the time of the Exodus after the 10 plagues. Reading Exodus chapter 12, verses 36 through 38. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they lent unto them such things as they required. And they spoiled the Egyptians. And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 on foot that were men beside children. And a mixed multitude went up also with them, and flocks and herds, even very much cattle. The mixed multitude included many Egyptians who had come to fear the God of Israel and wanted to identify with his people rather than with the Egyptians who were being destroyed. A similar conversion was experienced by Rahab, the innkeeper of Jericho who hid the spies. Reading Joshua chapter 2, verses 9 through 11. And she said unto the men, I know that the Lord hath given you the land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you, when ye came out of Egypt, and what ye did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side of Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom ye utterly destroyed. And as soon as we had heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and in the earth beneath. Zechariah prophesied that this will occur again at the end of the age. Reading Zechariah chapter 8, verse 23. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. And with the Jews in favor and in power, it was happening also in Esther's day. There is, of course, always a danger in this. While many may be impressed with God's power and his providence in preserving his people, and while many may be thus led to truly fear the God of Israel, there may also be those who convert for the wrong reasons. There may be those who convert to curry favor, who are merely conforming to what is now politically expedient. This is what happened when Constantine converted, and multitudes of pagans entered the church when Christianity was suddenly proclaimed the official religion of the Roman Empire. The church was seriously corrupted as thousands of nominal pagans entered the church, and syncretism became the order of the day. Chapter 16, The Destruction of the Wicked. Reading Esther chapter 9, verses 1 through 5. Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put in execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them. The Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus, to lay hand on such as thought their hurt, and no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon the people. And all the rulers of the provinces, and the lieutenants, and the deputies, and officers of the king, helped the Jews, because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame went out throughout all the provinces. For this man Mordecai waxed greater and greater. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. The day has now come, the day that Haman had appointed, because his astrologers and wise men had told him that this was the most favorable day for the destruction of the Jews. But it happened according to the word of Isaiah, who prophesied in chapter 44, verses 24 through 26. Thus saith the Lord, thy Redeemer, and he that formed thee from the womb, I am the Lord that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, that spreadeth abroad the earth by myself, that frustrateth the tokens of the liars, and maketh diviners mad, and turneth wise men backward, and maketh their knowledge foolish, that confirmeth the word of his servant, and performeth the counsel of his messengers. God has indeed frustrated the wisdom of Haman's wise men, and shown them to be fools. He had truly exposed the folly of liars and of diviners or fortune tellers, who think that they can predict the course of events and expose the secret things of God concerning his eternal will and purpose as it unfolds in history. God has most graciously confirmed his promises to his people and preserved them according to his covenant. And he has done this by a most unpredictable series of events in the lives of Esther and Mordecai. What fortune teller could have possibly predicted that Esther would become queen and Mordecai would replace Haman? Who could have foreseen that the king's unalterable decree by the hand of Haman would effectively be revoked by the king's unalterable decree by the hand of Mordecai? Who could have foreseen the fall of Haman from the heights of power to disgrace and death in a mere 36 hours? Truly, he drives diviners mad. But God has not only worked in a marvelous way through his providential control of history to deliver his people. He has also dealt with their enemies as he did in the days of Moses and Joshua. He has filled them with fear of his people, and with fear of Mordecai, their leader and their defender at the imperial court. As Moses promised his generation, so has God again done in the days of Esther. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 25. This day will I begin to put the dread of thee and the fear of thee upon the nations that are under the whole heaven, who shall have report of thee, and shall tremble and be in anguish because of thee. And then reading Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 25. There shall no man be able to stand before you. For the Lord your God shall lay the fear of you and the dread of you upon all the land that ye shall tread upon, as he has said unto you. Romans 8, verse 31, If God be for us, who can be against us? With such a God on their side, the Jews could not fail to overcome and destroy their enemies. And the irony of God's poetic justice continues. The day over which the Jews had mourned throughout the empire, the day over which Mordecai had clothed himself in sackcloth and ashes, has been turned into a day of rejoicing over their enemies. The day in which they were consigned to death in triplicate by the decree of Haman turns out as the day that their enemies are slain in triplicate, smitten with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter, and with destruction. Reading Esther chapter 9, verses 6 through 10. And in Shushan, the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. And Parashandatha, and Dalphon, and Aspatha, and Puritha, and Adalia, and Aradatha, and Parmashta, and Arisai, and Aradai, and Vehazatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hamadatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they, but on the spoil they laid not their hand. Solomon in his wisdom said, in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1, 3, and 8, To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to love, and a time to hate, a time of war, and a time of peace. In God's providence, this is a time to kill, a time of war. God has sent his people a great deliverance and has granted them this opportunity to destroy their enemies. When God grants such a time in the dispensations of his providence, it would be sinful to deny it. Of those that cry peace when God has declared war, the scriptures say, Jeremiah 48:10, Cursed be he that keepeth back his sword from blood. The Jews of the empire understand God's purposes and are not slack to take advantage of God's mercies to them. In Shushan alone, they slay 500 of their enemies. Particularly, they slay the 10 sons of Haman. In the ways of the Orient, these sons were probably committed to plotting to avenge their father and to destroy Haman's seed. Is to cut off his name from the face of the earth, the ultimate judgment. But preeminently, this is necessary because God had long ago decreed to blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven, and this is therefore the obedient fulfillment of his will and the completion of the commission that he gave to Saul centuries before. Also, the Jews wisely restrain themselves and show no covetousness with respect to the property of their victims. They do not mar the execution of their just vengeance on their enemies by appearing to the world as pirates and robbers. They nobly carry out the commission of their God, seeking no other reward than his deliverance and his blessing. Although the decree allowed them to seize the goods of their foes, unlike Saul and the Israelites of his day, they refused to fly upon the spoil. Reading Esther chapter 9, verses 11 through 15. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan, the palace, was brought before the king. And the king said unto Esther the queen, The Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee, or what is thy request further? And it shall be done. Then said Esther, If it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according to this day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. And the king commanded it so to be done. And the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day also of the month Adar, and slew 300 men at Shushan. But on the prey they laid not their hand. Esther, for all her humility and gentle ways, seems to understand the ways of the Lord. She is not about to hold back the sword at this time of divine deliverance for her people. Saul had held back the sword centuries earlier when he had a divine commission to smite Amalek, and the Jews of Esther's day were paying the price for that sin. She understands that in the economy of God, this is a time to kill. So when the king, upon notification of the events in Shushan, asks if she has any further requests, she does not hesitate. In revolutionary times, as the proverb goes, he who hesitates is lost. And these are revolutionary times. Haman has been overthrown, and Mordecai has assumed his office. The Jews, who were slated for destruction, have arisen and destroyed their enemies. When a former king of Israel was granted an opportunity to destroy his enemies, he hesitated and came under the rebuke of God's prophet. Reading 2 Kings chapter 13, verses 14 through 19. Now Elisha was fallen sick of his sickness, whereof he died. And Joash, the king of Israel, came down unto him, and wept over his face, and said, O my father, the chariot of Israel, and the horsemen thereof. And Elisha said unto him, Take bow and arrows. And he took unto him bow and arrows. And he said to the king of Israel, Put thine hand upon the bow. And he put his hand upon it. And Elisha put his hands upon the king's hands. And he said, Open the window eastward. And he opened it. Then Elisha said, Shoot. And he shot. And he said, The arrow of the Lord's deliverance, and the arrow of deliverance from Syria. For thou shalt smite the Syrians in Aphek, till thou have consumed them. And he said, Take the arrows. And he took them. And he said unto the king of Israel, Shoot upon the ground. And he smote twice, and stayed. And the man of God was wroth with him, and said, Thou shouldest have smitten 5 or 6 times. Then hadst thou smitten Syria till thou hadst consumed it. Whereas now thou shalt smite Syria but thrice. Joash's lack of militancy cost Israel. But Esther makes the proper response to the opportunity afforded her and her people by the king's continued generosity. She requests that the Jews of Shushan be granted an additional day to destroy their enemies. Like Joshua in his battle with the Amorites, she does not want the day of the destruction of the enemies of her people to cease. Joshua had prayed for more time to complete the destruction of Israel's enemies. Joshua chapter 10. Joshua had prayed for more time to complete the destruction of Israel's enemies. Reading Joshua 10, verses 12 through 14. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou, moon, in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hasted not to go down about the whole day. And there was no day like that before it or after it, that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. And Esther's desire is the same, and the king graciously grants her request for another day of slaughter of her people's enemies. She also shows her mettle in her attitude toward the sons of Haman. They had been slain, but she requests more. Her desires are, let them be hung like their father. Let their carcasses be displayed to their public shame and contempt. And let this be a warning to all who lift up their hands and seek to cut off the people of Israel. The fact that they are to be hung after they are clearly slain again confirms our earlier exposition that these are not gallows, but stakes that are used for a grisly after the effect crucifixion. Reading Esther 9, verses 16 through 19. But the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together, and stood for their lives, and had rest from their enemies, and slew of their foes 75,000. But they laid not their hands on the prey. On the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day of the same rested they, and made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews that were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day thereof, and on the 14th thereof, and on the 15th day of the same they rested, and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore the Jews of the villages that dwelt in the unwalled towns made the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of gladness and feasting, and a good day, and of sending portions to one another. The day of slaughter for the Jews' enemies was extended only in Shushan. This was not due to benevolence on Esther's part, but because there would have been no way to communicate the authorization of this extension to the provinces overnight. The Jews of the provinces, therefore, slew their enemies only on the appointed day, for a total of 75,000, and on the next day they feasted and rejoiced. The similar celebrations in Shushan were of course delayed by one day to allow for the extra day of battle. So ends chapters 15 and 16.